Well, welcome on this day. As we have seen, that has Christians began to witness, to evangelize, and as the gospel is spread out throughout the Roman Empire, that it was necessary for people to begin copying the books that were held as those from God himself. And as more and more copies were made, it became apparent that there were some differences among the copies. People were careful as much as they could be, but mistakes would crop in. Some of these would be corrected. Some of them would take a few generations to correct. But there would arise eventually some of these centers of textual criticism, such as the Byzantine text and the Alexandrian text and the Western text and the Caesarean text. And all of these centers of textual criticism were meant to take all of these manuscripts that were available and then come up with a text that was probably original, as much as the scribes and the scholars could detect. Now, as we go forward into time, there were some notable things would occur. For example, the text type in Egypt, the Alexandrian text type, would be halted in the early centuries, primarily because, one, the Egyptians stopped speaking Greek, so they stopped producing Greek manuscripts. And also, around the year 600 or so, Islam came through Egypt, and they destroyed churches. They just essentially wiped out Christianity down to just bare bones. And these manuscripts were kind of lost in time until more recent times. Then the church began to translate the Bible into other languages. And one of the most notable one is the translation of the Bible into Latin. And this was done by Jerome around the year 400. And he was at first criticized for doing that because of this one thing. He translated the Old Testament from the Hebrew text, whereas most Christians insisted that their text was the Septuagint because they spoke Greek. And there was this, of course, this divide between Judaism and Christianity, and the two sides were not really friendly. So Jerome's translation was at first resisted, but eventually it would be accepted. And for the Western Church, and I mean Rome and everything west of Rome, that was be the official translation of the church for well over 1,000 years.
So you're saying Jerome, instead of translating from the Greek, which was a translation of the Hebrew,
right.
He went to the original Hebrew to translate. Okay.
Yes, he did. Okay. Because as time went on, Christians became less and less familiar with Hebrew. There were not so many people who knew Hebrew, who were experienced in that language. And so the Latin Vulgate would be the translation of choice, the Bible of choice. In fact, it was even held in higher esteem by the church authorities than even the Greek New Testament. Now, when we come to near the Reformation period of time, there was actually very little of the Bible translated into English. Of course, back then it was mostly Old English or Middle English. But all the translations of the English Bible prior to the work of William Tyndale were done from the Latin text, the Latin Vulgate, and these were primarily partial translations, mostly the Psalms and the Gospels. Almost nothing else was in English. There was a few surviving manuscripts, such as the Lindisfarne Gospels, which date back to about the year 950. And this had, of course, the Gospels. And this manuscript is now in the British Library. Of course, even if you saw it and could look at it, it would be very hard to read it because it's in the old Anglo-Saxon, old English. And for us, that's practically a foreign language. But now with the disintegration of the Roman Empire in the West, the medieval church and the supporting state government put a damper on translations of the Bible into the vernacular languages, such as English. Latin was the only official recognized translation. And the biblical message would be presented to the laity primarily through pictures and paintings and preaching and poems and devotional phrases. Only certain portions were available in English. There were various people who translated portions of the Psalms and portions of the Gospels. But even these copies were reserved for the monks. You and I, the common people, if we wanted to hear the word of God, we would go to the priest. Because the Catholic Church, and as time goes on, this Catholic Church, this universal church, would become more and more Roman in the West. For example, and they looked with great suspicion upon a lay person reading the Bible. And because he could study it for himself, he could interpret it for himself, and to the organized hierarchical church, that was frowned upon. In fact, the French Council of Toulouse and in the year 1229 had actually forbidden the laity to read the Bible, whether it's in the recognized Latin Vulgate or in a translation in the vernacular languages. Non-Latin translations were eliminated. Of course, most people, even if they had the Latin Vulgate, could not read it. This was even before Pope Gregory VII, and this dates back to the year, say about 1085, He attempted to stop the circulation of a symbolic translation, saying this, and I quote here, "For it is clear to those who reflect upon it that not without reason has it pleased Almighty God that Holy Scripture should be a secret in certain places, lest if it were plainly apparent to all men, perchance it would be little esteemed and subject to disrespect, or that it might be falsely understood by those of mediocre learning and lead to error." So that was why the church did not want the common people, you and me, to read the Bible. If we wanted it interpreted, go to the priest, go to the church, listen to the Pope. Okay. Now, this anti-translation zeal is in contrast to the wave of translations in the first few centuries: Latin, Coptic, Gothic, Syriac, Armenian, Georgian, Ethiopic, Arabic, and Slavic. But as for the Western Church, only the Latin was recognized. And again, there were attempts to translate some of the Bible into English, the Old English and the Middle English, but very little was translated. And even what was there was reserved for the monks. So now we come to the time of John Wycliffe. Oxford scholar John Wycliffe. He was educated as a priest. He knew the Latin. And he wanted to translate the Bible from the Latin Vulgate into English. In fact, this would be the first translation of the Bible into any European language. John Wycliffe is known as the morning star of the Reformation because Wycliffe saw the church as being corrupt. And he believed that the way to prevail in his struggle against the abusive authority of the church was to make the Bible available to the common people so that they could read it for themselves and interpret it for themselves, so that they would know how to have a personal relationship with God through Christ apart from any ecclesiastical authority. Now, he was a religious advisor to the court of King Edward III, and at this time, he was kind of protected from the Pope because the English were at this time rather trying to distance themselves from the Pope, and so they protected Wycliffe. And even though the Bishop of London and the Pope of Rome demanded that John Wycliffe be tried for heresy, the English king protected him. And why was Wycliffe so despised by the Pope? Well, Wycliffe had this dominion doctrine. And basically that says that God's the source of all authority and he delegates the authority to man. He delegates certain authority to the state on secular matters, and he delegates the authority to the church on spiritual matters. And human rulers exercise this delegated authority only on condition that they serve God faithfully. Otherwise, they lose the right to rule. Hence, if the church leaders failed to live pure and blameless lives, the state is authorized to seize them of the property. And so the British crown liked that because, again, most of the wealth was invested in the church. So there was money to be made here. Also, Wycliffe challenged the church's principle that only the church theologians and the priests alone could properly interpret and read the Bible for the laity. Also, he wrote a book on the church, in which he defined the church not in terms of the ecclesiastical authority of Rome, but has an assembly of the elect, that those predestined to salvation, chosen by God from eternity past by the grace of God. Hence, the church is spiritual and invisible, with Christ as the only and true head. The church on earth is local, and it's filled with both the elect and the non-elect. But the Pope himself could only be the best at the head of the outward visible church that resides in Rome. That is, the Pope has no authority outside of his own little church in Rome. He also challenged the teaching of substantiation, or transubstantiation. And so he began this process of translating the Latin Vulgate into English. And he had a team working with him known as the Lollards. And it's a term of derision. This was given to them by their enemies, by the church. And they became persecuted. They no longer had the protection of the British crown. And a new law was passed that heretics can be burned. And who's the primary target of this new law? It's the Lollards. And so they survived underground. But they still managed to translate the Latin Vulgate into English. And of course, they would have to make numerous handwritten copies. Now, John Purvey would help Wycliffe and produce revisions in 1838, and 1396, which used English more naturally. Since Wycliffe had often kept the Latin Vulgate word order, even when it hardly made any sense in English. And about 235 copies of this Bible survive to this day, all handwritten, because the printing press had not yet been invented. But the church would fight back. So several years after Wycliffe had passed away, the church authorities dug up his grave and burned his remains and threw the ashes in the river, because that's what they do to those who opposed their teaching. Now, the Wycliffe translation is really a retranslation, because, you know, the Hebrew and Greek are translated into Latin, and Wycliffe translates the Latin into English. So it's really not technically a translation. Now, the first translation is by a man named William Tyndale. And this man was fluent in 6 different languages. He was skilled in linguistics. And he would learn Hebrew and Greek, even at a time when the study of Hebrew was still in its infancy. Of the scholars of his time, William Tyndale was probably the most proficient in biblical Hebrew. Now, why is this important? Well, in the previous century from William Tyndale, two events happened that had a profound impact upon Western Christianity. Number one, it's the fall of Constantinople by the Ottoman Turks. And many of the biblical scholars fled Constantinople and went west. They took their Greek manuscripts. And so the Western church now had these new manuscripts in Greek and Hebrew, and they began to study them. Now, Tyndale's desire to translate the Bible into English is exemplified in what he said to one of the church clergymen who opposed him. "If God spare my life," he would say, "ere many years, I will cause a boy who drives a plow to know more of the scriptures than you do." And he would certainly need the protection of God, because translating the Bible was still illegal. Well, so how can he do that? Well, because he had this desire to translate the Bible into English, he went to the Bishop of London for permission, because he would need that, and he believed that he could get permission because of this. The Bishop of London was good friends to a man named Erasmus. And Erasmus had just published a Greek New Testament. Erasmus had spent several years studying Greek until he was one of the best in the Western church. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to compare the Latin Vulgate with the Greek. And so he printed the Bible in two languages. One page was the Latin Vulgate, and he compared that with the Greek text to make comparisons. And this Greek manuscript, this Greek text that he produced, would be the basis of several translations after him. Now, the Bishop of London was good friends with Erasmus, and so Tyndale thought that he would get permission. But the bishop got suspicious, because he perceived Tyndale as being Protestant. He disliked Protestants. So he flatly said no. So what was Tyndale to do? Well, during this trip to London, Tyndale was preaching at a church, and this cloth merchant named Monmouth heard Tyndale preach and offered to fund the project. And so for the next year, Tyndale stayed in London and developed his plan to translate the Bible. Yet, he could not do so in London or anyplace else in England, because they knew who he was. If they found out, he'd be dead. So he decided to go to Europe. Primary reason is that in Europe, no one knew him. And even if the church authorities decided to track him down, it's going to be hard to find one person in all of Europe. So he decided to go to Europe, even though Europe was mostly Catholic. But still, no one would know him from anybody else. And he chose to places that had access to a river that flowed into the North Sea, because what he was going to do is he was going to produce these Bibles, and he was going to smuggle them into England by way of ship. So he would need access to a river port and also access to a printer who was willing to print. Because again, printing the Bible is also illegal. But as we shall see, there's money to be made. And when there's money to be made, people like printers are going to go for it. And so he would need a printer and also access to good paper.
Print or like Gutenberg print?
Oh, this is now in the age of the printing press.
Okay.
Right. This is no more handwritten manuscripts now. I did fail to mention the second great thing that happened for Western Christianity, and that is Gutenberg invented the printing press. Okay. So now printing was big business now. And these Bibles would sell initially for about a year, about a whole week's wages. Take for a moment to imagine your weekly wage. Okay, that's how much a Bible is going to cost you. And people were willing to buy a Bible. Now later as they got more efficient, the cost would drop, but they were still relatively expensive, but people were willing to buy them. Now church authorities did discover this underground circulation. They tried to confiscate every Tyndale Bible they could find. Because what Tyndale did was, he took his Bibles, or the printer took the Bibles, and they hid them in bales of cotton. And they would ship them back to England, and those who were receiving these bales of cotton would just take out the Bibles and then start handing them out, or selling them, I mean. And all these Bibles were sold out. But the church authorities labeled the purchase of these Bibles, or the sale, or the distribution, or the possession of this Bible as a serious crime. So they would try to buy up all these copies, yet this only provided more funds for Tyndale to produce more Bibles. And the Bishop of Rome even sent out spies with the task of locating Tyndale, having him arrested and brought back to England. But this proved difficult because Tyndale kept a very low profile. He lived off the grid. Now this is a book by Steve Lawson on William Tyndale. And you will notice that on the front cover, there's a portrait of William Tyndale. But this portrait, Tyndale did not set for this portrait. This portrait was done many years after Tyndale had passed away. That's how low a profile William Tyndale kept, or tried to keep. He made sure that no one could recognize him. And now the church authorities decided to discredit William Tyndale. In fact, this guy, Sir Thomas More, he wrote a 1,000-page book trying to discredit Willem Tyndale. I mean, he called him all kinds of names. Imagine someone writing a 1,000-word book to discredit you. You know, who would read it? Who would buy it? I mean, I'm not sure, but that's what they did in those times. If you wanted to win an argument, you would slander someone and just call them all kinds of names. Now, William Tyndale moved to Antwerp in early 1534 as a guest at the boarding house of Thomas Poyse, an English businessman sympathetic to the Protestant cause. Here, Tyndale worked out his revision of the New Testament, began translating the historical books of the Old Testament. Here he also met a man named John Rogers, who served as a chaplain of this English house, this English boarding house, and who, through Tyndale's influence, became a loyal supporter. And Rogers would also compile his own Bible, called the Matthew Bible, in 1537, after the martyrdom of Tyndale. So, Tyndale was busy translating the Old Testament in the safety of this boarding house in Antwerp. And the church authorities still could not find him. But then something happened. And there was this English businessman who had to pay off a large debt. And so he had sent all this money back to London. And he sent it by way of his son. His son's name was Harry Phillips. And this son proved a fool, because by the time he got to London, he had gambled the whole thing away. All the money gone. Now, imagine this son in London, gambled all his father's debt aside, away. I mean, how could he go back to his father? But the Bishop of London heard about this plight, and he called this guy into his office, and he made this deal. The deal was that if Harry Phillips would go to Europe, track William Tyndale down, and cause him to be arrested by the authorities and be put into prison, then the bishop would reach into the church coffers and make good on the debt. That is, pay off the debt. And Harry Phillips took the bait. And so he journeyed to Europe, and eventually he tracked William Tyndale down. And he became friends with William Tyndale. Now, the other businessman in this boarding house warned William Tyndale, you know, I think you better be careful with this guy. But William Tyndale, maybe a bit naive, didn't listen to them all that well, and became really good friends with Harry Phillips. Until one time, the two of them took a walk, and they walked right into an ambush. The civil authorities, the soldiers, arrested William Tyndale, and put him in prison. And he spent 18 months in prison in a cold, damp cell. And remember, this was back when you did not have internal heat. This was back in the European Ice Age, so-called. I mean, winters were brutal back then. And this particular winter, 1535, would be particularly harsh. And then William Tyndale was tried. It was a mockery. And he was executed on October the 6th, 1536. He was tied to the stake. He was strangled with a chain wrapped around his neck. And then his body was burned. And then the executioner, for good measure, even added gunpowder. So his body was blown up. But his last words were, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." Now, at the time of Tyndale's arrest, the authorities also went to this boarding house to confiscate all of Tyndale's work. John Rogers, he's a hero. He heard of Tyndale's arrest, and he ran back to this boarding house, and he gathered up as many of the manuscripts as he could before the authorities arrived. And it is with these manuscripts that John Rogers used to publish the Matthew's Bible. Now, Tyndale had also published the, by this time, Tyndale had already translated the Pentateuch and the Old Testament historical books of Joshua through 2 Chronicles, and also the book of Jonah before he was imprisoned. Now, he had an associate, Miles Coverdale. He also helped with the translation work. He was not all that proficient with Hebrew or with Greek, but so he did most of the translation from the German Bible, what Martin Luther had translated, as well as the Latin Vulgate. So Coverdale translation was completed in 1537. By this time, Henry VIII, the King of England, had broken ties with the Pope and gave approval to Coverdale's translation, which of course is based upon the work by Tyndale, whom Henry VIII had condemned. So Coverdale also set the precedent of separating the Old Testament from the Apocrypha. Before then, the books of the Apocrypha were dispersed among the canonical books. And Coverdale's Bible, they were all together between the Old Testaments and the New Testaments. And several people did not like that because they saw this as one more step to just getting the Apocrypha out. Okay. Historian Needham states this of Tyndale's translation. It's a fresh and original rendering of the New Testament, which formed the basis of virtually all English New Testaments until the 20th century, including the King James Version. The subsequent flowering of the English language into its full glory, most famously in Shakespeare, in the reign of Elizabeth I, owed much of its inspiration to Tyndale's New Testament. It would not be going too far to call him the father of modern English. So he's the father of modern English. He's also the father of the English Bible. And you might also call him the father of the English Reformation. Now, here are some of the distinctives of Tyndale's translation. The covenant name of God in the Old Testament is translated or transliterated Jehovah. Now, how do we get this name? Okay, let me just review one thing for you. Okay, you know, I said that in biblical Hebrew that it was all consonants. Okay, there were no vowels, and the reader, when he read from the Holy Scriptures, he would know what word to pronounce. So he would add the appropriate vowels and so read it. Now, at one point of time, the Jews stopped pronouncing this covenant name of God. And they would either substitute the word Adonai, which is Lord, or they would say the name. And this covenant name in Hebrew is YHWH. Now, eventually, they just... Now, the reason why they did not pronounce his name, because they felt that if they mispronounced the name, that they would be desecrating the name of God. So they chose not to pronounce it, but instead they would pronounce the name Adonai, which is the Lord. By the way, in most English translations today, this is rendered as capital O-L-O-R-D. This name is capital L, small O-R-D. Now, so when the Masoretic scribes came along, they put vowel markings in with to designate what the vowels are, because they were concerned that people could just lose Hebrew and not know how to pronounce it. So that's what the Masoretic scribes did. But when they got to this word here, they did not know how to pronounce it, because no one had been pronouncing it for generations. So what they did was they put the vowels of Adonai into the consonants of this name here. So they get something like that. Now, they still did not pronounce the name. They still pronounce the name as Lord or Adonai or just simply the name. So, when William Tyndale translated from the Hebrew text, he saw this word here. And what he decided to do is to transliterate it into English, so we get the name Jehovah. Now, actually, to be precise, there's no reason why you can put these vowels into these consonants and create a name. All scholars today will tell you that the proper pronunciation of this name is Yahweh. And now, I want to be careful here. I'm not going to say this is wrong. I can respect how it's used. I can, but still, everyone today agrees this is the proper name, Yahweh. So, now, of course, so that's that one. Also, Tyndale did one more thing that really irked the church authorities. This word, Greek word, ekklesia. He translated it congregation or assembly. In the New Testament, it emphasized that the church is a local assembly of believers independent of the current ecclesiastical hierarchy. And basically, that's what the word means in Greek. It's a congregation. It's an assembly. It's a people called out for a single purpose. And most notable, the translation is in simple, everyday English. It's simple even for the plowboy. And he used language in such a way that it was very natural for English-speaking people in that day. So, this was a revolutionary translation. Now, it was during this time that a political and religious change was being made. King Henry VIII in Parliament broke away from the English Church, broke the English Church away from the Roman Church. Now, though Henry VIII did not necessarily make any religious reforms towards Protestantism immediately, there were two church leaders, Thomas Cranmer and Thomas Cromwell, that encouraged the king to authorize a translation of the Bible into English. And the first Bible was Coverdale's Bible. And that was published and given support, approval from the king. Also, Thomas Matthew was a pen name of John Rogers, another associate to Tyndale. He also also made a translation which was also approved by the king. Now, John Rogers used Tyndale's 1535 New Testament. The Old Testament comprised all the texts which Tyndale had translated together with Coverdale's translation for the remainder of the Old Testament and the Apocrypha. Now, here's what John Rogers did that was so controversial. He put footnotes in his Bible, 2,000 of them. Some of them rather controversial. For example, he would make notes that were somewhat anti-church, anti-Catholic. It was a very Protestant translation because the Coverdale's Bible and the Matthew Bible had royal approval. The notes and book summaries each gave such affront to so many groups that Henry VIII decided to authorize yet another translation, and he chose Coverdale. And Coverdale, what did he do? He used Matthew's Bible without the notes. This Bible, published in 1539, would become known as a great Bible because it's big. Its title page would feature a woodcut engraving that depicts Henry VIII, Thomas Cromwell, and Thomas Cranmer distributing Bibles to the people who cry out, "Long live the King," and "God save the King." And a second edition of the Great Bible was published the next year, 1540, to be known as Cranmer's Bible, because it contained a preface by Thomas Cranmer and some further revisions on Coverdale's earlier work. And there will be five editions that same year. Now, what's interesting is that some of these editions had notes from Bishops Turnstall and Heath, had overseen and perused the edition. That is, these bishops had approved the Bible. But what they approved was largely the work of Tyndale, whom they had condemned. Now, as Henry VIII would die in 1547, his son Edward VII would come to reign, and he supported the Protestant Reformation, but he did not live very long. In 1553, he died. And then his sister Mary Tudor, the son of Catherine of Aragon, now descended the throne, and she was Catholic to the limit. She tried to turn England back to Catholicism. Mary Tudor, of course, is known as Bloody Mary, and she earned that title. During her reign, many Protestant reformers fled England to settle in Geneva, the home of John Calvin. One of these reformers, William Whittingham, who was also John Calvin's brother-in-law, completed a New Testament translation in 1557. This would be known as the first English New Testament translation with verse divisions. So now we have verse divisions in a Bible. And then italics were also introduced to indicate where English idiom required words that were not in the original text. So one more new feature of your English Bible. Now this Bible would be known as the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible would be the Bible of the pilgrims as they journeyed to America. It was the Bible of Shakespeare, of John Milton, and John Bunyan. During the long 45-year reign of Queen Elizabeth, this Bible would see nearly 100 editions. Even after the King James Version was published, the Geneva Bible would still remain the most popular Bible in England for many years. And the notes were Calvinistic. So this was a Bible that Protestants really, really enjoyed. But others did not. Many English bishops did not like the Calvinistic tone of the Geneva Bible. So they produced their own revision of the Great Bible in 1568 to serve as a pulpit Bible. These revisers were better scholars in Greek than in Hebrew because their New Testament work is much superior to that of the Old Testament. And the resultant Bishop's Bible was just not the caliber of the Geneva Bible. And although the Geneva Bible was a much better translation and much more popular with the English people, the Bishop's Bible would serve as the official basis for the 1611 King James Version. So we have all of these Bibles. There's a Tyndale Bible, there's a Coverdale Bible, there's a Matthew Bible, there's a Great Bible, there's a Geneva Bible, there's a Bishop's Bible. All of these Bibles we now have. Plus there's also, which I don't mention, there's a new Catholic Bible. which was translated not from the Greek and Hebrew, but from the Latin Vulgate. So now we come to King James. So 1604, King James I was summoned to the Hampton Court Conference to address a list of grievances against the Anglican Church signed by nearly 1,000 Puritans. The king wanted reconciliation. He wanted both sides to get along. He failed. But during this conference, one of the Puritans recommended that the king authorize a new version of the Bible for everybody. So the king liked that because this Geneva Bible, which everybody liked, he did not. And this Bishop Bible, which he liked, but no one else liked. So he thought, well, let's get one Bible and then we can be at peace. Because he disliked the Geneva Bible because there's some notes there that really irked him. For example, the Hebrew midwives. They were criticized because they lied to Pharaoh. But they were commended because they disobeyed him. And the king did not like that. Also, there was a criticism for King Asa because King Asa did not execute the king mother, his king mother, for her idolatry. And that reminded him reminded the king of the execution of his own mother, Mary Queen of Scots, during the reign of Elizabeth. So King James had reason to replace the Geneva Bible. So the king selected nearly 50 Greek and Hebrew scholars on three committees at Oxford, Cambridge, and Westminster. The king instructed them to follow the text of the Bishop's Bible. That's going to be the foundation. Unless they found that the translations of Tyndale, Matthew, Coverdale, and the Great Bible, and the Geneva Bible, were more closely agreed with the original text. They were also recommended to avoid any marginal notes besides those pertaining to literal readings from the Hebrew and the Greek. That is, he did not want anyone commending the Hebrew wives because they disobeyed Pharaoh. Because these absence of interpretive notes would help the translation be accepted by all the churches in England. So the resultant authorized version, later known as the King James Version, was technically not a new version or a new translation, but a revision of the Bishop's Bible. And the King James Version supplanted the Bishop's Bible, which was no longer being printed in the churches. But it took longer for the King James Version to replace the Geneva Bible in popularity because initially people did not like the King James Version because, well, it's a government Bible. I mean, how would you feel if our government came up with their translation of the Bible? Would you trust it? Maybe not. So these Puritans hated this King James Version. And they said, well, we got our Geneva Bible. We like it. It's proven. And we're going to keep that Geneva Bible. So the king decided, well, I'm going to get rid of this Geneva Bible. So he made a law saying after this certain date, it's illegal to make copies of the Geneva Bible. So he thought, that's going to get rid of the Bible. Well, what did the printers do? Well, they just changed the date so that it looks like it was printed before that cutoff date. So there's always been ways that people have used to get around laws that they don't like, I suppose. But some things never do seem to change. By some estimates, 80%, maybe 85% of the King James Version is really just a copy or close copy to that of Tyndale. But the King James Version did retain many of the ecclesiastical terms found in the Bishop's Bible, such as this word bishop, which in most translations is rendered overseers. Now, the King James Version has become an enduring monument of English prose because of its gracious style, majestic language, and poetic rhythms. No other book has had such a tremendous influence on English literature. And no other translation has touched the lives of so many English-speaking people for centuries and centuries, even to the present day. That's from Philip Comfort. Now, three editions of the King James Version came out that same year. And many more would come. Now, and changes would be made periodically. And in 1769, Benjamin Bainley of Oxford extensively edited the text to produce what has come to be known as a standard text of the King James Version, although slight changes would continue afterwards. And so from the early 19th century, the King James Version has remained almost completely unchanged. Now, one thing I will point out, okay, this is a King James Version. It's not the 1611 version. This is basically the 1769 version of Bainley. Now, but even this is not like every other King James Version. There's a Cambridge version. There's an Oxford version. This happens to be an Oxford version. So there's different King James Versions today. And plus, I also note that even the editor of this version that I have has made some changes to words from the 1769 version of Bainley. Next week we're going to talk about, what happens next? Because although the King James Version is a remarkable translation, and for its time, a very, very good translation, and it still is, even though it's not a vernacular translation. Its English is not what you speak. And words have changed. Some words have changed their meaning. Some words have become archaic. So it's not nearly as natural for us to read as our other modern translations. But it did have some weaknesses. It used the Masoretic text for the Old Testament, but the scholars had limited understanding of Hebrew. It would take many, many more years to understand Hebrew, to gain experience in the Hebrew vocabulary. So now in our modern translations, we have the gift of several hundred more years of research into these biblical languages. So they had a good Old Testament text. In the New Testament, they had this Textus Receptus, which is from Erasmus, and from other editions of the Greek text. And it was somewhat inferior because it's based upon maybe a dozen Greek manuscripts. And it's also a product of textual criticism. And it does have some issues. So we're going to talk about those next week. Well, it's time to close, so let me pray.